Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy weekend, friends, and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this every single week. It's a selection of my favourite chats from the last couple of days. It'll serve as a warm ear hug for you and yours. On this week's podcast, to celebrate Halloween, we looked into the Irish fairies that emerge at this time of the year, including banshees, mermaids and selkies. Also, author Nick Harkaway tells us about his father John le Carré's life from British spy to Corkman, and actor, writer and mad yoke from Cork, Norma Sheehan came in to tell us about her brat summer. We begin, however, in the podcast with author Sheena Quinn and illustrator Dermot Flynn, who've released a beautiful book about Irish mythology, and we called on the services of some of Ireland's most astute child reviewers during midterm break to give us their take on the latest twist of our ancient folklore. Brace yourselves and remember, always be nice to the little people. After that, Nick Harkaway. He's a successful novelist in his own right, but he's taken on the huge task of writing his late father John le Carré's iconic character George Smiley into a brand new novel. It has thankfully worked out really rather well. And he spoke to us about his father's difficult childhood, his changing accent, and why he wanted that harp on his passport. And then at the end, the brilliant and slightly dangerous Norma Sheehan, who we know from stages across the country, came in to talk about her comedy show Wine O'Clock. Having recently divorced, she told us about her very weird court dates, her weirder Tinder dates, and how 50 really has become the new 30, even though she's 48. And that's everything in the podcast. I'll be back on the wireless as ever, RT Radio 1, 9 till 10 every weekday. So off we go into this. Oh God, I nearly forgot to play my little Halloween music here to get us in the mood. There we go, for some spooky, shape-shifting storytelling. It's Halloween. We thought it was fitting to talk about the fairies, who you'll see or maybe not see this very evening. Sheena Quinn has written The Fairy Isle, Tales and Traditions of Ireland's Forgotten Folklore, illustrated by Dermot Flynn. Welcome, Dermot. They've taken a very grave risk, these people, in sharing these nearly terrifying and gorgeously evoked stories of the little people. And they're here in studio before the fairies find out what they've done. Sheena.
Hi, Oliver. Thanks a million for having us on the show.
Are you worried, by the way?
I'm not worried, no, because I have a number of things to protect me. One of the main things how you can protect yourself from the fairies is always be kind to other people and good with animals.
That's very hard.
Very hard.
Okay. Can you eat the animals? Will the fairies be okay?
There's a number of tricks that I've learned during my course of research.
Okay, and yeah. Dermot, you're okay as the illustrator?
I'm really trying to be nice to people, actually.
You've illustrated the fairies and they're...
Trying, yeah.
They're really cute in places. And then they're really scary. I mean, you need to be a brave kid in many ways.
Oh, very brave,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, speaking of bravery, thank you for letting us cross your threshold without wearing a costume.
Oh no, I'm dressed as a radio presenter. Yeah. Nobody has found out yet. It's a costume. Come here. It's a really fun, it's a beautifully illustrated book. It does a lovely thing because it introduces the fairies and then tells us a great story about them.
Yeah.
But it's actually based on folklore collections, isn't there? Our national collection.
Yeah, our national folklore collection in UCD, which is amazing, and the school's folklore collection. But also during my research, I found that William Butler Yeats had written about folklore. J.M. Singh, Douglas Hyde, William Wilde, Lady Wilde. So loads and loads
of books.
Crept
into all the literature.
Crept into loads of literature.
What is in the folklore collection? These are kind of, or this is the history that kids have written down.
So it's the school's collection. So kids had written, there was 350 accounts of sightings of leprechauns, which Walt Disney used for his research on Darby O'Gill, the film that was released in 1959.
He famously came to Ireland and did all this research.
And then there's stories on selkies and pukas, headless horsemen who are known as the Dullahan. So there's, light stories, and then there's absolutely terrifying, very dark stories.
Okay, so you did all your research there in the National Folklore Collection.
Yeah.
Dermot, where did you, as the sketcher?
My mum and father are from Kilkenny and Leitrim, respectively. So around where my mum is from in Kilkenny, I found a map, there's all these fairy forts around North Kilkenny.
Yeah.
And then where my dad is from, I went around, he grew up on the side of Loch Allen overlooking Slievenearen, which is where the fairies apparently first arrived in Ireland. And it was near Glencar where WB8 wrote The Stolen Child, set in that.
Oh, yes.
So I spent a couple of weeks just travelling around the west of Ireland. And I went to the Folklore Museum as well, in near Castlebar. So there's a lot of stuff in there, like, you know, the cradle where the changeling is, for example, and the shoes that the leprechauns
one of the worst ones. So, the changeling.
So, yeah.
That's not my child.
No.
Oliver, this is serious. It's not funny.
No, I'm sorry.
It's not a joke about.
It's not, nothing to joke about. You never know who's listening.
No.
I'll offer them e-numbers later on. Yeah. But that's interesting. And they claim the fairies first, they decided Leitrim was the place to land.
Well, there's loads of tiny fairy, yeah. My dad, he worked in the mines in Erigna, and apparently there's stories about the fairies diverting mountain streams into neighbouring mines to destroy them and all this. So there's there's mermaids in Loch Gill, there's mermaids in Loch Allen, all this. So there's a lot of stuff going on up there.
God, there is a lot. And it's true, like, we are afraid to touch hawthorn trees, the lone trees on hills.
Yeah. And never pick them. I remember years ago bringing some into my house, picking flowers for my mum, and she was like, no, no. And that's, you know, she started talking about the fairies and it was amazing. And then I remember she bought me a copy of Sinead De Valera's book on Irish fairy tales.
That's where you...
And that completely ignited, sparked my imagination, which was amazing because I loved the way basically it was just ordinary stories, and was one of the first times I read fairy tales that I was like, oh my God, this could happen to me. This is in Ireland. Even though it was years ago, I was like, I could be walking through a field and encounter a leprechaun, because I loved the way it was like ordinary situations and then something, an extraordinary encounter. You know?
There's also that in the DeLorean factory, apparently, the guy he cut down a hawthorn tree because his builders refused to do it. And that's why apparently
and
went under.
Naturally, the whole thing.
You see, that's the thing. Well, planning applications have been diverted because of hawthorn trees. You know, loads of
proper order.
Been denied. Yeah, proper order.
I mean, the fairies were good legislators in the day. We could do with them now. We really could.
Yeah.
Only very brave children should dare go into the fairy aisle. Stories. Give us an overview then of the scariest characters.
So the scariest characters, and as you progress through the book, we've tried to keep the scarier stories at the end of the book. So we've got the Headless Horseman, who's known as the Dullahan, and stories about him are so terrifying. Irish immigrants brought them over to America.
Yeah.
And the legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving was influenced by the Dullahan.
Who's best known for the Rip Van Winkle story.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm obsessed with it. I love that. Because it's Tim Burton's best film.
Yes, it's brilliant. Yeah, absolutely.
Even though he changes the story, because Ichabod Crane, I think, is a teacher in the town.
Yes.
Whereas he's an outside investigator in the film.
Yeah, God, I might even watch that this evening.
It's a great Halloween tip. You'd need to be in the 11s and 12s, I think.
Absolutely. Well, this book is 8+.
There's comedy horror.
Comedy horror. And then at the very end of the book is the scariest, and there are lesser known fairies, and that is the Shiri. Sometimes they're called the Wardishiri. Oh my God, Oliver, they
really
are terrifying.
Scary.
I scare easy. So I literally, you know, they appear and there's like little lights and you can see little faces with like sharp teeth. So absolutely terrifying. Mm. And they can basically, if you get lost in a bog, you can be there forever. Or bog bodies. Who knows? That may be the explanation for bog bodies.
They could be hovering around there.
Exactly.
And well done on that, Dermot. You've given us something for our nightmares, the little floating.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Floating face hovering over bogs.
I know. I thought I was dark until I met Dermot.
And the fairies have these kind of scientists, friends of theirs, who put out, there's only some kind of gas coming out of the bog. You're imagining things.
Smokescreen. It's all PR.
Completely. It's to lure you in. They're also known as corpse candles because they would lure people to a watery grave.
Corpse candles?
Yeah. Mm. Because you would think there was candles on the bog and you'd be like, oh, there's people out in the bog, and you'd wander out into the bog.
These are stories for children, should say.
Yes. That's why they're at the end of the book.
Yeah.
They're really good. They're brilliant to read out, particularly towards the end. Yeah. And kids love this sort of stuff. Look, we sent it out to a couple of young readers.
Excellent.
9-year-old Edie, she's from Greystone. This has changed her perspective entirely on fairies.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which I don't know if the fairies are going to be particularly happy about this because. Edie now knows things about the fairies.
I thought that the book was really, really nice and the illustrations were very beautiful and helped me understand what was going on in the story. And I learned that fairies don't have to be little twinkly things in the air that give you money when you lose teeth or that live in little doors in your room.
So she's going to be correcting everyone she meets now in school.
Well, that's good. I'm glad.
Some of them are small and some of them are very big.
Are very big, and some of them pass as humans.
Right. Yeah. They could be sitting next to you on the bus.
Yeah, exactly. Or in front of you being interviewed by you.
Or in the pub.
We will be surprised. A lot of people will be surprised to hear that the Banshee, Mermaids, even Leprechauns, they're classed as fairies.
That's correct. Yes. Mm. Yeah, they're all classed as fairies.
And the Banshee, I mean, the word itself, isn't it?
Is fairy woman.
Fairy woman. Yeah. Banshee.
So she is fairy in Irish and Ban is woman.
Because there was other folklore, isn't there, about the Sí Gaoithe, which was the fairy's wind. The
fairy wind.
Yes, yeah.
Crops, but the Banshee, she's of the fairies.
Yeah, dark fairy, yeah. Yes. And also sometimes, you know, people think that she's terrifying, but, you know, sometimes she would prophesize, you know, she'd come and prophesize. It wasn't always about death.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
What'd she prophesize?
She would prophesize like fortune, good fortune or bad fortune.
And what sound does she make for good fortune?
I don't actually know.
You might hear the whale.
I haven't heard. She hasn't visited me yet.
So. Yodel?
Yodel, yeah, maybe. Or maybe a whoop.
A whoop.
But there are knocks on the window and I know people who say they've heard those knocks before a relative has passed away.
Yeah.
And I think down in Yall, my mother's paper from East Cork, there were so many, not sightings, but hearings of Banshee whales that they scoured the beaches of Yall for weeks on end with flashlamps and everything. But
that's incredible. Sometimes ships at sea in the Atlantic meant to have heard her as well.
Leo's from County Wicklow. He's 9 years of age and he gives us his review on the Banshees section.
Okay.
I really like Fairy Isle because I just love learning about all these creatures that I don't really know about too much. And my favourite one is the Banshee because I knew about it already, but I didn't really know that some people thought it was like a ghost. Some people thought it was a professional keener, and it said a professional keener was a sing mourner, I think. And yeah, I just really, really enjoy reading these books.
There you go. Great review.
That's amazing. That's a great review. Yeah. So basically, keeners were professional mourners and you get paid for it. I didn't realise that either. And you go around to different funerals and...
This is 19th century, isn't it?
Yeah, 19th century. You wouldn't just get free sandwiches and a cup of tea. You'd actually get paid for...
Free moans,
yeah. I've seen a few undertakers now put on a bit of a show.
Oh, have you?
A few who have a really excellent resting sad face.
Yes, yes. Mm. Yeah.
There's a text coming in already on the fairies. I just heard your guest speak about National Folklore Collection. I was thrilled recently to see some of my grandmother's childhood writing. Dorothy Hillis was her name.
Excellent.
Held within the collection as a child. I loved hearing about the Banshee, the man with the cure, the Maybush and so on. Was fearing that these tales are being lost. Not so.
Thank you. That's great.
I have seen a headless horseman in Green Hills Park, Dublin 12. We'll lay that specific. Everything went cold for a second. Wind came and the horseman carriage came through and literally disappeared into thin air. No one believes it, they added in.
Wow. Well, I believe it.
Me
until
too.
Now. Yeah. So a delivery, perhaps? There's industrial estates, aren't there?
Delivery, yeah.
But the headless, I love. Yeah. Selkies, I don't know too much.
So Selkies, actually there was loads of stories of Selkies in the Irish folklore collection, especially around from counties Mayo and Galway and Kerry. And apparently the O'Flahertys and the McNamaras are believed to be descendant from Selkies. So often it was usually a woman for some reason. And the 9th of May or the 9th of any month, they would come to shore for some reason. That was their special number, was 9. And stories of Selkies where they would be stranded, man would find them, bring her home, she'd recover, he'd hide her cape and they'd get married and have children.
They're lovely stories that set along the coast as well.
Exactly,
aren't they?
So, absolutely.
The fairies like inland, really, don't they? They're like kind of drumlins and things.
Yes.
Yeah. Selkies tend to get it. Fia was a big fan. Fia's 8 and she's from Dublin.
It was a very nice book and slightly grim. I also liked it because it's full of magical things. And my favourite one was probably the Silky. It's about a Silky who gets washed up on shore. And after 7 years, she already has like, I think, 4 kids and has married. And at the end, she dives into the water, never to be seen again. I would recommend this book for nine or over year olds, because it can be a bit creepy in some of the stories, like the Banshee.
The Banshee. That's 8-year old Fia saying really 9 plus for, but she's fine. Obviously, yeah. She's
okay, good.
Scholarly about these things.
That's brilliant. The reviews plus. Are fantastic. Thank you, Oliver.
Because they can be nerve wracking.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Tough crowd. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. I like that it's only slightly grim. You need
slightly,
to work harder.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Dermot, we had people texting us even earlier this week going, what is the Pooka? Because we were talking about The Unreal, which has a Pooka, but it's based on a kids' show version of it. Was the Pooka to you? Because you had to bring all these characters to life for us.
Oh, well, the hardest thing with Pooka is just to how to figure out what he looks like. So he's part man, part horse, part goat. And he's a real trickster. There's a very nice side to him. I think that's the sense I got from it, but a really mischievous side as well. I think I heard Eddie Lenihan tell stories about him. You can catch him if you use iron kind of stirrups and stuff where you can take him for a ride, so you kind of, you know, you can bend him to your will.
Oh, wow. But only Eddie Lenihan, storyteller Shanachie, would get away with it.
But I think it's usually when you're on the way home from, if you're walking home from a pub in the night out, and he'll arrive beside you on the side of the road, and suddenly he whips you off onto your back and takes you on a wild, crazy ride. But so there was a story I heard once about someone who bent down on the way home from Kilkenny City, and they bent down to tie their shoes, and a gust of wind hit them, and they turned around and walked all the way back in, and only realised when they got to town. And then I think they tried to say it was a Pooka as well, but I don't know what the story is, you know.
But people were brewing their own alcohol in those
days. Yes.
Out of things that grew in hedges.
No, yeah.
Some Dermot in Kilkenny says the Headless Horseman spotted in Green Hills Dublin 12 was Deliver Boo.
Oh, very good. That's oh, very brilliant. Good, yeah. Very good.
That's the mood we're in today. On Mermaids, Ellie from Kildare is our last reader reviewer. So let's hear what Ellie made of the mermaid section.
I absolutely love learning about folktale creatures. I like the way Sheena Quinn explains the creatures before she tells the story, because I wouldn't even think of that myself if I was writing the book. I learned about some of them in school, like Pooka, the Leprechaun, and the Banshee. And I actually think that Sheena Quinn explained it better than I did in school. And I actually liked the Northern Lights in the mermaid section. I love the way John falls into the water and then the mermaid helps him back up. And when I heard about the mermaid on the rock in the middle of the Shannon, if you saw it, you'd die a year later. It got me a tiny bit scared, but I still liked it as well.
They're so casual about it, aren't they?
Yeah.
You'll die a year later.
Make the most that year. Yeah. You know, yeah.
That's great that she loved that story. Actually, when I was researching for The Mermaid, the stories that I found, as Gráinne, our editor, said, they were just too dark and too deathy. So I had to recreate that story. And that's just totally...
Okay.
And I was influenced by the Northern Lights. It was in May when we could see the Northern Lights. And I just thought, you know, the beautiful greens and pinks reminded me of like maybe Fishtail. So that was the spark of that story.
And obviously a dream for an illustrator.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, the whole thing was, it was great. I loved working on it.
Have you had any night terrors in recent times? Are you being, because that would indicate whether how well this is being received by the fairy community.
Not so much, no. I think it's very
I sense you shutting down there. You've done a deal, haven't you, with the fairies?
Myself and the Banshee have exchanged words, should we say, exchanged howls to... And thankfully, actually, my sleep is much better now that I've released these tales into the wild. So maybe my work is done.
She sings me sounds to of sleep. Coins jangling. Sell the book. Sheena.
I signed an NDA, so I can't say anything.
Like I said, they're really good legislators and contract lawyers.
Yeah. But I can tell you this for nothing, that I'm not going to spend any time near a bog or... you know, wandering freely on my own on Halloween night.
It's one of the many reasons why we need to leave the bogs alone and don't go meddling in them, no matter how much you want to put potting compost in your window boxes.
Exactly.
No. Leave the bogs alone. The window boxes fall off and smash for a very good reason often. Thank you to our book reviewers, by the way. That was E.D. from Greystones, Ellie from Kildare, Fia from Dublin and Leo from Greystones, and Oliver at RTE.ie for our other reader reviewers who are coming into us as well. It's a gorgeous book. Well done. It's a lovely hardback thing. The Fairy Isle. Sheena Quinn, thank you very much for coming in. And Dermot Flynn, happy Halloween to both
much.
Of you.
Happy Halloween so to you too.
This is the Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1 podcast.
The late, great David Cornwell was first a British spy, then the internationally acclaimed author John le Carré, and at the end of his life, an Irishman. His son has now reintroduced his father's legendary spy master, George Smiley, in the brand new novel Carla's Choice, to the delight and excitement of all the le Carré fans out there. Nick Harkaway, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Where is the greater risk or the greatest amount of pressure for you? Is it taking on the iconic Smiley in the new novel or stepping away from your own acclaimed writing for a moment at least?
Oh, good question. It feels as if there might be a risk wherever I go. I think it has to be the first one, the you know, this incredible canvas of 20th century writing that sort of defined the Cold War. And I have the sheer hubris to say, oh, yeah, I can do that.
What exactly is George Smiley's legacy to the world. It's a big question.
But it is a big question.
He's such a figure.
What I would like to think it is the idea of compassion, even in the kind of, in the grey zone between two kind of enormous clashing ideologies. You still have to do ultimately the right thing if you can, you know, which is kind of, you know, Smiley tries to do the right thing, not just in this book, but elsewhere, even when maybe he shouldn't, you know, and when he crosses that line, he's very conscious of it and he's very unhappy with it. And I think, you know, as we look around the world, we could probably use a bit of that.
Yeah, I think your father really, he was kind of inspired by, in a negative way, the James Bond version of espionage. And he wanted this kind of sophisticated, closer to reality version. And out of that comes the unlikely figure of George Smiley. Is that fair to say?
I think that's probably fair-ish, yes. I mean, there was that very James Bond sort of version, and then there were sort of Bulldog Drummond stories, very kind of muscular and militarised. And he wanted to tell a story about people, you know, who are flawed and who experience these kind of impossible dilemmas, and, you know, and tell espionage stories from that place.
So you and your family, you decided we'll bring George Smiley back, and rather helpfully, your father has left plenty of gaps in the George Smiley canon, huge gaps, as it turns out, timeline-wise, which you to kind of mine all of these extra stories.
Gaps and wiggle room, because the dates shift a little bit, because he wasn't writing franchise, he was writing novels. Mm-hmm. And so, but there's a 9-year gap in the storyline between The Spy Who Came From the Cold, the definitive kind of Cold War noir story, and Tinker Tailor, you know, which was sort of much more Byzantine and ornamented and so on, into which I can fit this story and have it belong to itself. You know, it obviously can reference those two, but it has space to be its own thing, which is, you know, I think terribly important, because you don't just want to be doing infill, you want to do something that has its own merit.
And into this, the spy, it's really directly after The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, essentially, isn't it? But George Smiley is still, he's still in grief for what
yes.
he did there, just as the yes. Cold War had begun. Well, the Cold War was underway, but the Berlin Wall had gone up.
Exactly so, yes. And it's interesting, when my father wrote Legacy of Spies in 2017, or came out in 2017, he was suddenly struck by Smiley's involvement in what happens in The Spy Who Came From the Cold, which I won't spoil. But I found it, he found it incomprehensible. And I actually think, in the context of the Cold War, where it felt like this kind of looming darkness, you know, I think actually everything that happens is understandable, even if it's not right, you know. But so I wanted Smiley in grief. And of course, there's a kind of mirror there for me as well, because, you know, this is my dad's world, and he died in 2020. And here I am kind of, you know, stepping in.
Very soon, because, well, you've effectively already stepped in, because the last time I spoke to you was about 3 years ago with Silverview.
Yes, yes.
Which was, that a complete novel? Did you have to finish it off? I can't quite remember.
No, it was absolutely complete. Well, for that, we had the manuscript or the typescript, but yeah. We didn't, you know, but you can't just print the typescript. You have to go through the edit process to make it kind of, you know, tidied up. And so I sat in the chair for that one. But I don't think there's more than three lines of that I wrote. And those are obviously kind of linking passages to just make edits make sense.
Mm. I presume you've read the New York Times. They've been looking back at Silverview, haven't they? Assuming these are some of the things in Silverview that your dad couldn't say while he was alive, and that you've now carried on through Carla's Choice.
Yes, that's right. Well, I don't know about couldn't say. He remained, in a funny way, very loyal to his old service. He kept all their secrets. So people always kind of assume that at some point he would have sat me down and told me, you know, this is what I really did in the Cold
yeah,
War.
Yeah.
But he never did. So anything that I know about him is also in the public domain. I have no secrets in that regard. But so he kept their secrets, and they knew that. A lot of, you know, people, old intelligence officers used to sort of sidle up to him in the street and say, terribly nice to see you, and I'm always very admiring, and so on. You know, it was, and they'd sort of pop out from round corners in bookshops. It was actually kind of Peter Sellers-like.
And this is your life, because you remember as a child your father reading out these passages of his latest novel.
Yes. Yeah, always. Every morning he'd get up very, very early and he'd work and he'd have coffee and come to the breakfast table and he'd read to my mum across the table the new pages. And then, you know, she'd type them and he'd read them again and so on. And there was an interplay between them. And so he was writing the Smiley novels in the 70s and I was born in 72. So actually, while I was acquiring language and learning to speak English, an hour and a half of my day at least was Smiley. So when I came to write this book, he was just waiting for me.
George Smiley taught you how to speak, essentially.
Yeah.
Some of the language. Well, there's no better mark for your credentials on writing it than that, if you didn't already have them. Smiley, his motivations we know, and they constantly are being ploughed through in the story, but his operations are, in your father's book, always sort of, he's at a distance, isn't he? He's like a passive character in many ways, where you make him both passive and active in this story.
Yes, I mean, he's definitely pulls the strings in Tinker Tailor rather than kind of doing the difficult stuff himself. But, you know, but we also know retrospectively that he did something quite daring in the Second World War. We don't know what it was, but he was frightened. He was in Germany and so on. And so that's sort of canonically known. So we know he was a field agent. So I thought we'll give him a little bit of that, because here we are. It's the early 60s. You know, he hasn't quite just decided to sit behind a desk yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, but at the same time, again, very much not James Bond. You know, when it gets dangerous in the field, Smiley's not happy about it. Doesn't enjoy that at all. There's no kind of, ha-ha, now I shall do this. It's very much, oh, no.
I love him trying to remember his field training for a car chase.
Yes.
Drive very fast and don't hit things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and that's, you know, I have this conviction also that one of the reasons that we love Smiley is the sense that although he's a sort of Sherlock Holmesy genius, we also feel that he's kind of us.
Yes.
You know, he's ordinary, but with skills we might acquire. And so the notion that he, you know, if that was me, I would 100% be going, oh, I can't remember. Hang on, what am I supposed to do at the corners? You know, do I slow down or do I speed up and hope?
Always middle-aged as well, isn't he? Does he grow old?
I will thank you to call him in his prime. He's the same age as me.
Okay, very good. Our prime.
Our prime. He remains, for the most part, he remains a kind of undifferentiated 50-something. Mm. But then he gets a little bit older when he retires in Smiley's People. But his age is a little bit all over the map.
Just an amazing, brilliant character, and you must be pleased, because doing something like this, so high profile, was going to attract the attention of the exalted publications of the world. I presume you've been reading the reviews, because they've been so good.
I have a cast iron rule that I don't read them,
but
my wife reads them. I get the highlights, but then I'm also shielded from anything that will upset me. You know, and I mean, which I have to say there hasn't really been.
Well, I mean, the Telegraph asks, is this new Le Carré even better than the master himself?
As you will perhaps be unsurprised to hear, I feel a bit ambivalent about that one. On the one hand, I'm delighted. On the other hand, I feel a little bit kind of disloyal even hearing it.
Mick Herron, who of course people will know from who wrote The Slow Horses, a note-perfect tribute, fits seamlessly into the world of Smiley's circus. I mean, there's quite a lot of Smiley in his world, isn't there?
Yeah, and he came and he gave the memorial lecture for my dad down in West Penwith in Cornwall. We had the first lecture a little while ago, and he was brilliant, and he was wonderful about my dad, and you know how much he admired him, and so on. And also, I mean, I don't know if you must have had Mick on the show, but he's one of the nicest men in the world.
Really?
You know, so that's also just a great kind of, you know, it's a lovely thing to have Mick kind of saying that.
I wonder, are some of the reviews in saying maybe it could be better because of the times we're in? The reviews are mentioning that your female characters are more rounded than previous Le Carré novels, which I think even your dad touched on himself, didn't he?
He did. Well, and it's, you know, it's one of those things, without wishing to get armchair psychiatry about it or psychology about it. He, his mother left when he was five for good and sufficient reason, by the way. You can't blame her because his dad was a monster, you know. But that relationship was never repaired. You know, he found her and he had her, you know, they knew each other and he looked after her when she was old. But you know, it was never made good. Mm-hmm. And so to some extent, in the earlier part of his life, you know, what women did was disappear on you. You know, that was his emotional bedrock understanding. That changed as he got older. until in some of the post-Cold War novels, actually, you know, as it gets on, the female characters are very strong, and he was working very hard towards that. And I have a particular fondness for a couple of them because they have hints of my wife in there. But in some ways, the book is obviously a little bit anachronistic in terms of his style or whatever. Because I'm pushing the things that he wanted to be achieving later, maybe a little bit into the Smiley corpus. But I feel it blends. You don't really, you know, if you're a reviewer, you might notice. But in 2024, if you're just a reader, you go, yeah, no, of course.
Just talking about Ronnie's, who you're talking about, which is your dad's father.
Yes.
And he's the inspiration in A Perfect Spy, isn't he? It's incredible.
Yes, very much
incredible,
so.
A novel. So Le Carré put his dad in the stories. Is your dad in yours now?
I think he is, in the sense that I think I poured bits of him into Smiley. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to some extent, he's already Smiley. He has to be, because you know, you create a character like that. But you know, there's always this conversation about whether Gwilym is my dad and Smiley is the sort of father figure he made up and so on. So for me, I put my dad into Smiley.
Okay. What did you put in specifically?
I put in, well, with the relationship between George and Anne, I wanted that to make sense in a new way. I wanted people to see it and want it to work and see why it didn't.
Right.
And with my parents, it's the opposite. Their relationship was sort of non-conventional in a way, but it worked brilliantly. And so it's the inversion of that. But there's, you know, their interplay in some ways is similar. But and my dad's kind of sense of as I say, compassion and slightly kind of horror at how the world works is in Smiley.
I mean, Smiley's, he's very happy, certainly at the start of this story.
In this, yes, exactly. Well, because obviously, when you're a novelist, if you want something to be awful, you show it wonderful first, and then you take it away.
So it's almost difficult to talk about Carla's choice in many ways, because as in the Le Carré novel, and this is where you're being praised quite a lot, it starts out with a plot that untangles beyond where it starts out, essentially.
Yeah, it always somehow begins with something trivial. And again, I think that's very Sherlock Holmesy. You know, it's a sort of it starts as an interesting problem, mm-hmm. and then of course it turns out to be the critical thing. Writing it was a very kind of nervous dance between the raindrops in terms of not revealing things that shouldn't be revealed and so on.
Well, also the fact that it's so different from what you have been writing. Genre melding novels, dystopian, futuristic thrillers, a bit of spying here and there, but sort of dreamlike qualities to them, isn't it fair to say?
Yes.
Was your dad a fan of your own writing?
We always had these very interestingly fraught conversations where it was never clear to me how much of my books he read. He was always, you know, he always sort of announced that he dipped into it, quote unquote, and you know it was very good and so on. But I never
he didn't
read a lot of fiction generally. And I said this to my brother the other day, and he said, "Well, you know, he used to claim that he was dipping in, but whenever I talked to him at any length, he seemed remarkably well informed about the twists and turns of your plots." So Simon's conviction is very much that he read them all. And he was very supportive and kind. So.
When did you start reading his novels?
I'm not even conscious of when I started, because they were, you know, like I say, they were ambient. I started listening to the Michael Jason audio recordings very, very early, as part of my kind of going to sleep if nobody could read to me, if they were busy or whatever. And then later, you know, I came to the books, but I couldn't put a date on it. It was just always there.
Are you a huge fan? Did you read absolutely everything? Did you have to reread to go back here?
I absolutely did reread, yeah. And I built a little kind of speculative timeline, because the dates are always a bit contingent one on another and so on. So I've got a notional timeline of Smiley's Circus and so on. And yes, I am a fan. But also, you know, I mean, you talked about kind of the difference between what I normally write and this. And the thing is that when I came to it, I think because of that thing about sort of Smiley being my kind of learning to speak companion, I didn't have to turn the dial very far to find a voice which is absolutely mine, but which people read as being his.
Extraordinary. It was sorry. I'm again sorry to see or sorry to read that you lost both of your parents really quickly after each other. Your dad went first. He was 89, almost 90.
He was almost 90, yeah.
At the end of 2020. And he died an Irishman.
He did, yes. And in a really... That was a really big thing for him. He went and made a visit, and the archivist sort of threw wide her arms and said, "Welcome home." And he was so moved. I think for most of his life, really, without knowing it. He was looking for a place that would take him in without condition, you know. And here it was, and it was just, and you know, she was prepared to say welcome home just on the strength of, you know, who he was without asking. And that meant something to him on a fundamental level.
I want to play it here. It was in October 2019, and he was being interviewed by Marion Finucane, who's a huge deal in Ireland. She was a huge Le Carré fan, always wanted to interview him, and she managed to do so just a few months before she died herself. And it is about this coming home for him. He was furious about Brexit, and he really wanted that Harbin's passport. Let's have a listen.
I was completely enchanted by my journey to Ireland, where I visited my grandmother's birthplace in Inchinatin, near Roscarbery in County Cork. And that was where she grew up, and that was where, at the age of 16, from there, she went to England as a lady's maid. I went to Skibbereen, where there is a heritage centre, and a wonderful lady called Margaret Murphy, an archivist, first of all, rather sternly, looked at her computer for a long while. And then she turned up to me and with a beautiful smile and said, welcome home.
And there it is.
And it was very, very shortly before he died, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I have to say, the wonderful thing is, by the time I heard that story, she had a kind of leather-bound book rather than a computer. It got better in the telling.
Yes, he was a good storyteller.
He was
in
a
person
good storyteller.
As well, yeah.
I love it. So there we go. Now I'm educated. But yeah, no, and I tell you, listening to his voice is extraordinary, because that's his voice in late age. And then as you go back, you hear the sort of the deeper, slightly less crackly version of that. But there's a transition moment where when he was in the 70s, particularly in the 60s and 70s, when he was first famous, he had a very fake High Etonian voice, which he used for interviews. Yes, it sounded sort of, yes, when you write a novel, people ask you the question, did you make this up, or were you? And it was nonsense. It never belonged to him. And he actually says in the Pigeon Tunnel, the interview for the documentary film that they made, he says, I adopted the class and voice, the manners and voice of a class that was not my own. And I hadn't really heard it because I was too young.
Yeah.
And then I was listening to that on one of the kind of clips. I was like, good Lord, what was this? And if you can get hold of it, the audio book that he read of The Spy Who Came From the Cold in 1981, he starts out with the American-handed Limas another cup of coffee, and then he goes into the American voice, and he can't do the crazy British voice, and he goes into his own for a couple of lines. And I was listening to that. I was like, that we should make a show just about that. Because this kind of adopted voice giving way to the real one, because it's who he really was.
I mean, the lovely story for us is that this once MI6 spy finishes off as an Irishman.
I cannot tell you how much it meant to him. When he died, I'd actually started, and I'm not even going to try, I'd started learning Irish, and we were going to learn it together.
Oh, really?
We wanted to do a journey together into Irish and Ireland. Mm-hmm. I got cracking on it. And then, you know, obviously when he died, I got a little bit, it fell away for me rather, because it was a bit painful because we never quite started off. I can't emphasize enough how much it meant to him.
You became fluent in Smiley instead.
I became fluent. Thank you very much. I'm going to use that. Yes, exactly. I did.
Do you? Would you qualify for an Irish passport yourself?
I wouldn't. I'd have to come. And I do. I think about it quite a lot, actually. I haven't sort of stepped in that direction yet. But it's always actually, and my nephew is getting married in Ireland to an Irish lady. So.
Oh, great! The connection.
The connection is yes. We're all kind of
you've a great
we're
grandmother.
All aware.
Yeah, so you would actually need the circus and perhaps even control to get involved to
yes,
secure.
Yes, exactly. No, for him. It was a really real, tangible thing, and it was something. There's a silly picture. I gave him an Irish flag on his birthday because he just got the notification through that he'd been registered, we were all a bit plastered inevitably. So there's a photograph, and it's of course upside down. I think he then put it on his chair in his workroom upside down too. So we've got this kind of glorious but terribly embarrassing picture. But I don't know whether it makes it better or worse that he was maybe a little bit the worse for booze.
I've seen that photograph. It's a joyous one. It almost makes sense that it's upside down. There's an SOS, kind of inevitable.
Yeah. Well, and I said it to someone the other day, a friend of mine from Ireland, who said, you know, well, frankly, you want to see how many times that gets done by people who should know better. So,
I hope you still have the flag.
Oh, I do, except that I've actually lent it to the Bodleian because there's an exhibition of his archive. And I made them promise that they would get it the right way round.
Yes, OK. Because I would say it is a brilliant artifact, so it's even better that it's on display.
Well, and it is a brilliant artifact, although obviously it's a slightly embarrassing kind of not very well-made one that I bought from a certain online retailer in a hurry.
Yeah, I think it's lovely that your whole family are involved now in the whole Carré legacy, and between the films, the documentary film was there. Will there be more now from you or others in terms of George Smiley? Are you going to go back to your own work? What happens next?
So first of all, when I said I would do this, we kind of made a very light touch agreement that I would be allowed to do my own stuff as well. If I was going to have the opportunity to do more of these, I would alternate or something. So I will do more of the things that I would normally be doing. And in fact, I've got Sleeper Beach, the second Cal Sounder novel, coming out next year. Whether I do another George Smiley novel is sort of slightly contingent on how this one goes. And after this weekend, it's looking rather likely because it's, you know, the reception has been so extraordinary.
It's going to be a clamour.
So I have some notes towards the next one, but we haven't sort of put that in stone.
There will be a clamour for film versions as well. And because because you're doing this, there's obviously that the shades of a row about Gary Oldman, isn't there? His agent claiming that you blocked him.
It's actually his manager who said that. Yes, but because I'm not really involved. I couldn't answer that. And of course, because they had pictures of me from previous stuff, they put me front and centre of that story. And I was sitting there going, hang on, there's three sons and two of them are film producers. One of them's a novelist. Who are you going to ask about this? But I don't know what's going on there. But I tell you what I do know is that the other thing that's been said recently is, why hasn't Gary Oldman got a knighthood? And I think that's a great question. I think we should all call the palace. Honestly, I think that's a good one.
Well, you won't be a true Irishman if you're calling for people to be knighted, for goodness sake. We frown on that sort of thing.
Well, you know, but I mean, you know, a little bit of fancy dress never did anyone any harm.
OK, look, that's an answer that that Ronnie would be proud of. Never mind Smiley or anybody in there. Nick Harkaway, it's been a pleasure chatting to you. Thank you so much. Carla's Choice is absolutely magnificent and a worthy successor or involvement in the whole Smiley universe. So enjoy to everyone, all the fans out there who are going to get their hands on it. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is the Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1 podcast.
You're all very welcome back. That was the Scissor Sisters there just before the break. Now, November is a very dull month, so you need to go out and enjoy yourselves, and you all need to plan nice things to do as well in January, when it's kind of the November of the new year, basically. So no better person to join us today to tell us about what to do and go to this show. Yes. And it's called Wine O'Clock. Norma Sheehan, welcome. Studio.
Thank you very much, Oliver. It's great to be here. It's great to be here. How are you?
Wine O'Clock. I sort of said, you could come up with a better name than that.
Well, I was going to call it my Tinder Sexcapades, and I was going to call it, what was the other thing? Midlife Climax. But some of the theatres weren't keen.
Because you're touring around the country.
I'm touring around the country.
Keep every comedy happy.
Totally. And to be fair, what it is I did Shirley Valentine for years, the play, and it did great around the place. And it's kind of what Shirley did next. Everyone wants to know what Shirley did next.
Yeah.
No, sorry, it's my real life.
But
though.
This is
it's
actually
my
like
actual
a memoir.
Life.
Yeah.
Like, okay. So I turned into Shirley, and this is what Shirley did next. I finished Shirley, got divorced, very amicable. Kids were encouraging it. Teens are getting me out there. And I dabbled a little bit in Tinder, which is a massive part of the show. It's just like
it's
a jungle.
This is semi-autobiographical,
It's all a bit. I mean, I'd add.
Come here. What is the etiquette now? The etiquette if someone is divorced, do you say, sorry to hear that, / congratulations?
Please don't give me the tilty head. Oh, I'm so sorry. Like, just say congratulations. Like, that's what you have to say, because it's depending on the situation.
I get you.
My situation, I'd be the poster girl for divorce, because ours took 5 months from start to finish. And we're getting on great. We're now like colleagues in raising the kids. It's brilliant.
Wow.
Yeah. No,
and tell us the day that the divorce actually formalised. It's an extraordinary coincidence.
I was in court on my actual wedding anniversary.
Go away.
22 years married, to the exact hour, we're sitting there, two of us having the giggles, and the judge thinks I'm pulling the mick, obviously, because that's what I tend to do. And I had so many filters on that day, I was like, don't mess up, just keep it straight face. No. She was like, please, Miss Sheehan, tell the court the date of your marriage. I was like, gave the date, and she was like, not today's date, the date of the marriage. And I was, yeah, she was in stitches, and she went, congratulations.
The judge was laughing.
Yeah,
that's
so it was weird. But yeah.
And I'd say a rare day for them as well, because many divorces are very sad occasions, and
they are acrimonious. But we were together 20, like, I think after 10 years, you know, you deserve, you know, separate duvets at least. And then after 20 years, you should have an electric fence down the middle of the bed. And that's not even going to help with the snoring and the halitosis and the rest of it. And to be fair, I mean, I couldn't sleep with me. I'm one of these strangled cats. Like, oh yeah, I sound like I'm trying to strangle myself to death.
So fitness obviously isn't a cure for snoring, because you're
no,
a great shape.
No, well, I have a big nose. I don't know, maybe that's the problem.
Very hard on yourself.
Well, you're related to me. I mean, you did very well on the nose front. Sorry for anyone out there. We're about 75th cousins, apparently.
75th, well, third cousins. I think it's officially third cousins, which we discovered removed. Working together on The Matchmaker.
Yeah.
Never forget it. Still have the night terrors.
Sorry, we were doing a show together and my auntie Betty texted me going, you do know you're working with your cousin? It wasn't very intimate.
As we're jumping in. Well, we do get into bed together.
Well, you had the leg over, but at least there was...
that did not occur. thank God I did an adult content warning earlier in the show. So that was kind of lovely. The divorce is lovely. And, are you free? You're a free single woman straight afterwards?
Yeah, the show was going great. I was, you know, it was tricky getting out there though, because, you know, the last time I dated, there was no mobile phones.
Oh, right, of course. Completely different planet.
I'd be chronically dyslexic. If this is something I've made up myself, it's not dyslexic, it's dyslexic.
It's good, yeah.
So trying to get on the app, oh my God, getting a few pictures up there. And then if you're living down the country, you'd want a 50-mile radius, so you wouldn't be with your cousin. Whereas I'm in Dublin, I could sample every continent in a 5-mile radius. You know, it's handier up here.
Were your teenage daughters involved in setting up your profile and all of that?
No, my sister was. But in fairness, the daughters were like, get out there and get a life. We just don't want to hear about it. So hopefully they're not listening.
Never mention it.
They're great though. I've three teenagers. So with the divorce, two of them are identical. So we just
identical
said, look,
twins.
They're identical. Take your pick. We didn't. We three kids, and they're fabulous. But Halloween, I think Halloween should be banished, because Halloween. What's a teenager meant to do except drink vodka? Like,
I know there's not. It's
10 days of what the heck?
The midterm break. It's not like, a week long at this stage.
No, it's 10 days. There's two weekends in it, okay?
I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
The long weekend.
Anyway, sorry, they're happy out. But seriously, what are you meant to do with teenagers during... Anyway, sorry, that's...
Isn't that what horror movie... And that's what the nightmare realm and things
I should
are
have sent them into the parade last night in O'Connor Street. Yeah. I was down the Spiegel tent last night. I'm just thinking...
Stay there, it'll come any minute.
I could have done with a couple of the hundred from... Send them down, we could have squeezed them in the back from O'Connor Street.
You did a gig last on Halloween night.
I have about 3 hours sleep I've had. I'm now, do you know what? You know, two burnt holes in a blanket, the ghost? That's what's looking at you right now. I have a face for radio, I tell you.
Could people hear you with the fireworks and stuff going on?
That was tame enough. Oh, the Spiegel tent is mighty. Have you ever done it?
No, I've never done it.
We should do a show there. We could call it Cuz Buzz or something like that.
It'd be a great call for that in Ireland, to be fair.
There were Cuz Buzz. Oh, God. Anyway, let's not go there. No, Spiegel tent is amazing. And tonight there's two more shows there and there's another one tomorrow night. They're brilliant down there.
You're not involving you.
No, I was there last night.
Yeah. Spiegel tent's been going. It was one of those things that came out of the crash, really, wasn't it? In fact, all of the theatres and everything came out of the crash and people have been going non-stop since then when everything was pretty miserable.
Yeah, and you know what? I love a bit of filming, but oh God, I love the stage. That's where I started off years ago, and when I went to the RADA, it was all stage training.
You're
really
a proper actor, darling.
And I didn't get kicked out. Like, I thought I was going to be taken seriously when I went to the RADA. The Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And it's been very downhill since then.
They probably just thought, when is she going to stop doing that funny voice she's putting on?
Yeah, well, no, they loved me. They had me doing the Shakespeare lead. They I came out.
Did you do it in an English accent?
Totally. And then I came out and worked in the Abbey, and I was like one Enda Walsh plays in the festival. And now look at me talking about me bits around the country. but it's lovely to make people laugh.
It is. Now, I was noticing that when we were doing our promo to say that you're coming on, it was 50 is the new 30. Going, Norma Sheehan isn't 50.
It doesn't matter. Everyone thinks I'm about 70. So I just said I'd round it up. I'm 48. And so I can see. And to be fair, anyone over 35, we're all in the same boat. You know, get on with it.
In terms of women?
Yeah, well, men, God love them. I would say if you're looking for a man, get off the apps. because the poor fellas, they're addicted to the apps. And yeah, whereas it's grand for me, I was just looking for a bit of entertainment. But you'd have to come off it after a few weeks as well, or you'd need a hip replacement.
You did. Oh, right. Oh, I see.
I know, I'm only joking.
It really works then for...
Which is, you see, if
not for relationships.
It's good for my age because I'm as pretending to be 50. My limbs are still intact. So I'm no drama and blah, blah, blah. But I'd say if you were late 30s, you're looking for a partner, good luck getting a fella to come off the apps. They're sure this...
That's where the matchmaking comes in.
It's called sex on tap on the app. No, we're not.
Well, you said it. We gave due warning.
Correct, yeah.
But that's what... Did you get bored of it then, the apps?
No. I mean, I did it for entertainment value. Because I'd turn up and I'd meet a fella and they'd be barking mad. I mean, you know, they'd be like, oh, we'll get matching tattoos. We will, yeah. I mean, on the first date. I'd be like, I've no tattoos. The only tattoo I'll be getting is my name and address. So I know, you know.
Maybe it's just loneliness.
Yeah. And then there'd be other fellas, like, they, you know, they'd be lying about their age. I'm 45, but I did my leaving cert in the 80s. You did, yeah. So
Which is ludicrous, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't work.
Ludicrous. And then a load of the fellas, they're all on these diets because they're all bulking themselves up. So they'd be on the Aduco diet or the no protein or the, like, no this, no that. And I'd be like, yeah, no, zero crack, like, goodbye. So just a bit of fun. Yeah.
And despite the fact the show is called Wine O'Clock,
yeah,
you're not really much of a drinker, are you?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a bit of a yogi. Like, I did yoga last year, so that's good for the hip flexors and the hip openers and stuff like that. And
you're serious into it. I've studied. From the RADA to yogi.
Yeah. But sorry, I don't know why I brought that up. The reason with that, to be fair, like, I'm a really good person when I've one drink inside me. I'd like to have one flute inside me at all times. Any more than that just gets a bit messy, really. But I do. I think we should all have a little IV drip of just one drink. We'd all be happier. Just one.
But unfortunately, Ireland, one's not enough.
One's not
two's
enough.
Two's too many.
No.
Is that the phrase?
Yeah, two's too many, yeah.
But one is perfect. Then.
One is perfect. But to be fair...
Because you're like this now... Stone cold sober, 3 hours sleep. We can all imagine you.
I would never need drugs really or coffee. I would just need one drink to it's a
don't
drink is a sedative.
It is.
It is true. So it calms me down. Like, I'll drive down to Cork to have a whiskey with my dad the whole way down. And
a little Tisheen.
Yeah. In fairness, he's got the optics along the kitchen. During COVID, they lent them. They shut the pub down.
It doesn't
in the
really though.
He does. There's optics along the shelf in the kitchen. Yeah. The measures that you put the drinks in.
But he drinks very responsibly.
Oh, he does. No. But yeah, totally. Yeah. It was just for the vulnerables.
What age is your dad?
He's 81. Yeah.
What does he make of your?
He hasn't seen the show yet, but his friend came to see it and down the country, and I brought him up on stage, and we had some.
That's
games.
A good way to do it.
Yeah. So he's got the good review.
I gather more men are going to this show than would have gone to Shirley Valentine.
There is a load of men coming, actually. Yeah. Like, I mean, we're in the Civic next week. Where are we? The Civic next week, and then Castle Morris, and yeah, loads of places.
I think it's something like, we go here now and discover what women in their 50s, that one there in their 50s know.
Well, the one venue we were in down the country.
We get the information now. Come on with me.
There was three lads, they were running the theatre and they came back at the interval and I thought they were going to throw me out and not let me do the second half. They're like, Jesus, can we book in another date here? The audience are loving it. And can you extend the interval? Because they're mad for the drink. Can we give them another 10 minutes? Yeah, that's the name of the show. So it is laughter from start to finish.
You also encourage people to hug during the interview.
I do, because we need human touch. I do think, you know, whether, you know, if you're married, keep up the jiggy, or do what my sister did. She took up tennis so that their relationship would be jigged up a bit. And I do think if just a bit of human touch, because I have a friend who's a barber and she said this fella's come into her every week. They don't need their hair done, but they haven't had a hug from one week to the next. So I do think we do need a bit of human
touch. So that happens at the shows.
We went out into
the interval at your show. People are drinking.
They're drinking and hugging.
Irresponsibly and hugging.
So there's group therapy, there's hug therapy, there's game therapy, play therapy. There's other therapies we won't mention on air. So there's Tinder tutorial. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
the comedy show actually gives you a Tinder.
Yeah,
tutorial.
No, it's just a repeat of what my sister gave me, really. Like, it's not actually a formal Tinder tutorial. But it's a warning. It's a warning for what's out there.
And that's also great because all the respiratory illnesses, you'd have that over and done with as well early in the season.
Totally, absolutely.
By hugging everyone. Well, that one's coughing. Quick, hug her.
We have to hug. And actually, we're going to Cork and to the Opera House. So we're doing big venues as well, like the Gaiety and the Opera House. You know, that'll be trickier to get everyone to hug.
Do you call that your home place?
Even Cork Opera House. Absolutely, yeah. So that'd be good.
When are you doing Cork Opera House, by the way?
That's I think that's February, and then Gaiety is May. But to be fair, we're doing kind of everywhere from Cork to Castleblaney, from Waterford to Galway.
In Cavan.
Manahan. Which one of them is from Cavan?
No one from Cavan. My mum's East Cork, so that's where
I know your mum's East Cork, but your dad is...
He's Monaghan, pure Monaghan.
Did you not have a Cavan connection?
Look, everyone from Cork thinks we're from Cavan all the time, you know?
Oh, God, that's so bad.
You're a Kevin Monaghan, it's all the same.
Monaghan. And do you have a
dog? People there, you think Tipperary's Northern Ireland.
Do you have a dog yet?
No dog.
No dog?
This interview's about you.
Because the people like you get a hammering in the show for... You know, we used to all envy your, you know, fun life. And then you decided to get married. Some of you want
kids.
But
this is the gays.
Yeah, the gays. Oh, yeah. And then I used to I'd wake up dreaming to be a gay. And then you decided you'd get married and have kids and have dogs. I mean, dogs are worse than teenagers. You can't send them to school.
I know, even the gay divorce phenomenon hasn't quite caught on yet. It's not around long enough. No. Be 10 years next year.
And I'm not promoting divorce now, by the way. Can we get this on air?
Because that's a good point.
I'm just saying don't get married and don't have kids. That's all I'm saying. Right. That's it.
Okay, so the tour is all across Ireland basically. Well, you're doing the Civic and Tala in November and Claremorris in December.
And at the Axis.
But how do we find it then? How do people go out there?
Oh, look, I'll shove it out there.
Wine O'Clock.
Norma Sheehan on Facebook, or Norma Sheehan. Oh, and City Theatre Dublin has it up there as well. My producer Michael Scott is bloody amazing. Oh my God. And he's got that sellout show in the Gaiety at the moment, Squinting Windows.
So, the Valley of Squinting Windows. Yeah. We've covered it all.
You have.
Yeah, we cover the good stuff.
So I'd be lost without him now. He's my boss man.
Congratulations, divorced Norma Sheehan. And good luck with Wine O'Clock. Sure, where else would you get it? Banshees, mermaids, selkies, the British spy and his Ivory Coast flag, and listener discretion for Norma Sheehan and her Tinder tips. It is the end of the podcast, as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime at all, oliver@rorte.ie. Happy weekend to yous all. Farewell, Sloan.